extra dimensions. So this is chapter 7. So we will leave supersymmetry for a couple of days and then just concentrate on another extension of the space-time symmetries in four dimensions. Remember that in the first lecture I told you that we're using symmetries as a basic tool to go beyond the standard model. A natural way to go is to extend the symmetries we know. And there are two types of symmetries, the internal symmetries and the space-time symmetries. Internal symmetries bring us to grand unified theories and so on. And the space-time symmetries were of two types. The space-time symmetry were of two types. One was supersymmetry that we have been discussing so far, and the other is probably more obvious, and of course it was proposed earlier, is just to extend the number of dimensions of a space-time, so then we have more space-time symmetries. So this is extra dimensions. Notice that in a way, supersymmetry, what we are doing is just adding also extra fermionic dimensions. Whereas these are extra bosonic directions, in the sense that this we extend the space-time to superspace, but here we are just extending in the natural way, just to have real physical dimensions, as we observe now in 3 plus 1. Okay, so this is the topic that I will start discussing now. And let me start with a little bit of history. Probably you have heard most of it, but for completeness. Of course, discussing extra dimensions in mathematics, that was not very hard to think when people were talking about Riemannian geometries and so on. You can just talk about manifolds of any number of dimensions. But in the context of physics, and to think about the idea of unification, this started in 1914. The work of Nordström, and then independently, 1919 and 21 by Caruzza. I think the original paper was 1919, but it wasn't published until several years later. And they wanted to unify gravity with electromagnetism. No idea didn't work because it was just before Einstein's general relativity, so he wanted to unify them in another fashion, just everything in terms of a vector field or so in five dimensions, so having the metric. So that didn't work. Whereas Caluzza just was right after Einstein, and he said, well, let's just take Einstein's theory in four dimensions and add a fifth one. I have to give credit here that Caluzza's work was very much based on ideas of Weyl, that these ideas that at the end introduced the gauge principle and so on in our days, although Weyl was doing it from another perspective. But that motivated very much the work of Caruzza. And then, of course, in 1926, Klein took the idea of Caruzza probably more seriously. And the difference between Caruzza and Klein is that Caruzza just said, well, let's assume there is an extra dimension, but nothing depends on it. So you don't see the physical dimension. Whereas Klein said, well, this physical dimension is there, but it's very tiny. It's a circle, for instance. The ideas of this was unify gravity and electromagnetism. And Klein now came up with the idea that the universe is like a cylinder. with the radius of this extra, this is the our 3 plus 1 dimensional universe, and this is a small universe of radius r, very small. So this is the fifth dimension, and r very small. So that you couldn't see. So that is what Klein's contribution essentially was. And after that, many people work on it. This is on and off. You can see Einstein's interest on this came several times in his career, and also people like Jordan, Pauli, etc. So. Ehrenfest, I think he was interested in this, and so on. But essentially, not that much progress as in the way that we regard it was made until 1960s. Again, 1960s. And here, well, several things happened. One is that there is a very nice historical anecdote. Is that in a course that Bryce DeWitt gave in Lesouges, 1964, he put that as an exercise, as, you know, like an example sheet we distribute for you, to generalize this idea of the fifth dimension to any number of dimensions. It's just an exercise for the student, which is very nice. So I have to give the credit to Bryce. But of course, this idea of extra dimensions, I think Pauli had already thought about extra, enhancing the number of dimensions, but Bryce, I think, but, very general. And but of course, the and then strings. And people proved that the strings had to be equal to 26 in the bosonic strings. So that was in the 60s, and then 70s and 80s. There was a lot of work on this precisely because of supersymmetry, actually supergravity. People realized something we didn't spend that much time discussing supergravity. People realized during those days that you wanted to build supergravity theories of extended supersymmetry, so with a supersymmetry n greater than 1, then it was easier to construct them by going to higher dimensions. And for instance, if the famous n equals to 8 supergravity that I told you was the maximum supergravity you can get, it was easier to get if you start from a theory in 11 dimensions. And actually, in here, 11 dimensions play special role. It was proved that it was a maximum for supersymmetry. This is the work of Nam, if I remember correctly. So the maximum number of supersymmetries implies that the dimension was the equals to 11 was the maximum number. And but it was also argued in a very elegant way by Witten. That it was a minimum number of dimensions. And the idea of the minimum was as follows. Look at this. The circle that we have here has a symmetry, and the symmetry is just shifts around the circular dimension, just the angular variables. And that symmetry it's a U1 symmetry, just it's an angular rotation. It's a U1 symmetry. And that's precisely the origin of getting electromagnetism out of the fifth dimension. So electromagnetism comes because of the symmetry of the extra dimension. This is just that was the elegant way of unifying gravity and electromagnetism at that time. And of course, you didn't have to go beyond one, because at this time, these were the only interactions that people knew. So they already have a unified theory of all interactions, because you have gravity and electromagnetism. That was everything you had. At that time, they didn't know the nuclear forces, the strong and weak interactions. However, when you want to go to try to say, oh, can I have the symmetries of the SU3 cross U2 cross U1 coming out of the symmetries of an extra dimensional manifold, so then you have to go to a higher dimensional object. And for instance, that's what people consider here, to go to beyond 5. And then we can ask the question, well, what is, if I consider this manifold, this extra dimensional manifold, to be a coset space, G over H, and I wanted to have the symmetries of the standard model, which is SU3 cross U2 cross U1, what is the smallest dimension that will have that symmetry? Of course, the higher dimension you have, of course, you will have that symmetry. So he asked the question, what is the smaller manifold of which is a coset that has the symmetries of SU3 cross U2 cross U1? And that's that manifold was, so Witten took the G over H to be a SU3 crosses U2 crosses U1 divided by maximum subgroup, which is SU2 cross U1 cross U1. And then you count the dimensionality of this space. This space will have the symmetries of the standard model, SU3 cross U2 cross U1. And you count the dimensionality. So this dimensionality of G over H. Yes, you want to have a manifold that has these symmetries. Then you can mod it out by a subgroup. So you mod it out by the maximal possible subgroup to get the smallest number of dimensions. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you for the question. And so the dimensionality of G over H is equal to the dimensionality of SU3 is 8. If SU2 is 3, of U1 is 1, minus the dimensionality of SU2 is 3 minus 1 minus 1, and that is 7, if I didn't make a mistake. So so that means that the full dimensionality of space-time will be 7 plus 4, that's 11. It's a beautiful thing. So he came with this beautiful argument in favor of 11, which is it was kind of a very nice and attracted some attention. However, at the same time, a year later or so, Witten again came back with a Keating thing for 11 dimensions. And so he said, the standard model is chiral. We know the standard model is chiral. We have been claiming that very often. And Witten said, well, if you start with any model in odd number of dimensions, you cannot get anything chiral. And 11 is odd, so then you couldn't get chiral. Okay. So this would be... Sorry? Should that be? Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, yes. Thank you very much. Yes, oops. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay, so then the equal 11 minimum, but he came also with the idea that the equal 11 is non-chiral. And non-chiral, the easy word to see is that there is no, in 11 dimensions we will see later, is no analog of gamma phi. Okay, so gamma phi, remember, in 4 dimensions that defines the chirality. In 11, in all dimensions there is no analog of that matrix, so then you don't have chirality. I think it's hard to see when you come down to 4 dimensions that you generate chirality out of just compactifications, and that actually, so that killed 11 dimensions. And But that was very good, because in the meantime, few people, like Michael Green here and others, were studying string theory. And string theory was not in all dimensions, was in 10 dimensions. And that's, then I came, we didn't say, well, that's the way to go. And everybody went there. Okay. So gravity is equal to 11, and then superstrings. The nice thing about that is chiral, but also superstrings have the big advantage that they're actually a candidate to solve the most important problem we have mentioned, which is the quantization of gravity. So that was the main, that should have been the main motivation to everybody to go to strings, superstring theory. But it took some time for people to actually move to in that direction, except for a few brave ones. And then, of course, 1990s. I counted it once, I'm not completely sure, but it's precisely 11 years after he killed 11 dimensions. Witten came back, came revived the equal to 11. Okay, and that's now it's called M theory. And of course, that is essentially seen as part of the whole picture of a string theory. It's not just a new theory or so, but it's just it's something that generalizes the string theories that we know, that there are different limits of one single theory. And one of the limits has an 11-dimensional supergravity manifestation. And of course, the other thing that came up in the 1990s is the idea of brains, and especially the brain world scenario. And this was very important because this allowed for the possibility of having very large extra dimensions. So large that eventually it may even be shown in LHC in a couple of years' time. So that probably is not the case, but in principle, it is possible to do it. And the reason to do it is because we have this brain world. The idea of the brain world is that we will have, our universe will be a surface inside a higher dimensional space. And that's nice because it is precisely from string theory, there's a natural objects, the deep brains that many of you have seen, are precisely have that property. And we can be living on a deep brain. Our whole universe can be just a deep brain. And that will have, that because of that, we will see in the next few days, why that thing implies that you can have very large extra dimensions at the level of being experimentally tested. So that's a very exciting thing. And of course, so that's how we stand so far. Okay, so let me start. Let me start with the...
Sorry.
Yes.
They are not extended, such extra dimensions.
Yes, there are extra dimensions, but yes, and that's very good. So we separate the world into, the extra dimensions in two sides. So we have a 10-dimensional world. So we are living in 10 dimensions. And six of the dimensions are small, so we don't see, for instance. But they are small, not as small as people thought in the past. They had to be this size. People thought they had to be the Planck length, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Now they can be small, but observable. So even to the limit of 0.1 millimeter, for instance, I can have that. That's extreme case. But then our universe can be just a D brain. And if it is a D3 brain has only three special dimensions. So we will be seeing only three special dimensions. And this special dimension, it will be living on an extra dimensional object, but we are trapped. It's like being trapped on a wall. So you're trapped on the wall, you cannot move out of it. Okay, so that's the thing. There's this extra dimension there, but you cannot go. And of course, gravity will fill the extra dimensions, but both quarks and leptons are trapped in the wall.
Why can't they be extended?
Why they cannot move to the extra dimensions?
No, why these extra dimensions can be infinity?
Oh, that's what your question. Yes, there is the proposal, and I will mention briefly Randall and Sundrum that precisely you may have. They have a particular model in five dimensions where the extra dimension can be as large as you want. Yes, and it is not easy to get that, and I haven't seen it realized from any string theory construction. Personally, but in a toy model of five dimensions, Randall syndrome had it, which is very interesting, I would say.
What's so special about gravity that it can feel the interdimensional?
Well, in a string theory, it's special because gravity comes from closed string modes. So, for instance, here we can have this will be our universe. This will be a deep brain, and then the quarks and leptons are made out of strings, and the endpoints are attached to them. Whereas the graviton is a closed string, so the string doesn't have any attachment to anybody, so it fills all the extra dimensions. So these are quarks and leptons. And this is the graviton, for instance. Even the gauge is also here. So that makes a real difference between gravity and the rest. Of course, we can have extra brains, and extra brains can play the role of the hidden sector that I was talking to you the previous day. That, for instance, you can have this can be supersymmetric. You can break supersymmetry in another world, say, and then gravity is a perfect mediator to tell you the supersymmetry was broken. Okay, so that's one of the pictures. Okay. I was planning to tell you this later, but it's okay. Thank you for asking. So, very good. So let's start. Let's start with the simplest case, and then we'll build up. Start with the five dimensions. And for 5D, I will start with the simplest case, which is a scalar field, then I will move on to other fields. A scalar field, then I will introduce gauge fields and so on, just to build up the general picture. So let's consider just a scalar field in five dimensions. So we start with an action, which will be the integral of d5x times d mu phi. I will call dm phi dm phi star, where m equals 0, 1, 2, 3. These are the standard, and then the four dimensional index. Okay? So, this is the simplest theory you can imagine in five dimensions. You just have a fifth coordinate to integrate over, so then the phis depend on all the coordinates xm. So phis are functions of xm, of course. And m goes from 0 to 4. So let's consider then that the fifth dimension, so x4, and we will call it y, and that will be a circle. Okay. So essentially, y will be a theta angle times the size of the circle. So that means that the space-time will be equal to the four-dimensional Minkowski times the circle S1. Okay. Since it is a circle, that means that the coordinate y is essentially a periodic coordinate. So you can go around several, I mean, when you go around 2 pi, you get to the same thing. So since that means that we have periodicity in the y direction, so that means that when you have a periodic function, it asks us to do something to it, and which is to do a Fourier expansion. It's a natural thing. So, So that means that I will write phi as a function of x mu. Now I'm writing the mu's as the standard four-dimensional coordinates, and then y as the extra coordinate. And this will be infinite sum from minus infinity to infinity of some Fourier coefficients that I will call phi n. It's the same letter, but just I'm putting an index. And it will be times e to the I theta, where theta is the angle, where I can write I n y over r, because y was the coordinate, so the angle is y over r, where r is the radius of the circle. And then, since I'm expanding on y, these x mu's are not part of the Fourier expansion, so that means that the Fourier coefficients should be a function of the x mu's. Okay. With r equals the radius of the circle. So that means that the periodicity here is y equals to y plus 2 pi times r. Okay. So this is a very simple thing. So we have a circle, so we have the Fourier expansion. Now, we started with an action, and the action was this is a free field in five dimensions. So we can look for the equations of motion corresponding to this field. And so a field equation, that means that it is a free field, it has no mass. So that means that it is just a simple dm phi equal to zero. Okay, so that is straightforward. But now if we plug instead of phi, we write the whole infinite sum in terms of Fourier expansion. So that means that we will have the sum over n of the n dm. We take first the values n, it goes through the mu values, so it will be d mu, and then they will be acting on the Fourier modes phi n. And then when n is y, so then we will have dy, but dy will bring us a factor of I n r each times we take derivative with respect to y, so we have a factor of minus n squared over r squared. And then times phi n. And everything, of course, will be multiplied in the phase over r. Okay? And
are those
indices
mu's or n?
Yes. This is capital M, and this is a mu. This is an important question. Sorry?
Is mu ranging over?
Mu? Mu equals 0, 1, 2, and 3. And M, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. Thank you. Yes. And of course, this will be equal to 0, because that's the right-hand side of this equation. Okay. So what is it that we are left with? We are left with this single equation, which is trivial in five dimensions, becomes This equation in same four, but since the exponentials are linearly independent, this implies that we have each term in the each factor has to be zero, and so then we have from one equation we are left with an infinite number of equations in four dimensions. And this is very nice because remember we started with a massless field in five dimensions. Massless, to be emphasized. And then what happened now in four dimensions? We have an infinite number of equations. We have now an infinite number of fields in four dimensions because the phi n, each of them being a function of the x mu's, is a field. And so we have an infinite number of fields satisfying now a Klein-Gordon equation for a massless, massive field. Okay, so that's the big step in the Kaluza. So we have so this is the Klein-Gordon equation for massive fields. And an infinite number of them. And the mass with mass equals n over r. So the mass will be a function of n. So for the field, the nth field, will have a mass n divided by r. And these are called the for n equal to zero, it's still a massless. And this is usually called the zero mode for clear reasons. And for n different from zero, these are called the Kaluza-Klein. Or momentum mode. Yes, thank you. Okay. So, what is it that we have learned from here? It's a very simple exercise, but we have learned that once we go to move to one extra dimension, one single field becomes an infinite number of fields, and they all with different, and the masses are split in a natural way. So this is called the Kaluza-Klein tower, because you have a tower of masses. Oops, sorry. You have a tower of massive modes. Have m equal to zero, and then run of r, 2r, and so on. Okay, so it's an infinite tower of states, and the ratio of the masses is always an integer. So it's a well-defined spectrum of states. Yes. Yes, but in this case, notice that it's a complex field. So in that sense, it's a natural thing. If you had you will have started with a real field, then we have this constraint that the phi, so that the minus n mode and the n mode have to be pair up to get the final result to be real. Okay. So this is a very simple exercise, but it gives us a lot of information. And okay, now we can still play a little bit with this, and we can plug the expansion that we had here for the field phi. We can plug it into the action, and so. And you will see that then the action will be. Let me call this action to be explicit, 5D. So then I have 5D. That will be the integral over d for x, integral over dy of the infinite sum over n d mu phi n d mu phi n star minus n square over r square phi n square and then this will give us the integral of dy will give us a 2 pi r that we can take outside the action, it will be integral over d for x. And then we can start expanding here. The first term will be d mu phi 0, d mu phi 0 star. That doesn't have a mass, so that's OK. Plus the rest. OK. And usually, since we can work, if we work at low energies, we work at energies much smaller than 1 over r. So all these massive fields will be too heavy, and they can decouple. So you can just integrate them out, say, in your effective theory, and concentrate on the physics for the massless mode, for the zero mode. So the zero mode will be the most important one, because that will be the one that is remaining at low energies. All the other ones will be heavy, and if they are too heavy, we can just essentially integrate them out. And this illustrates the difference between Kaluza and Klein. What Kaluza had done was essentially to forget about all these extra fields. He didn't have them. He just changed phi and phi naught as if they were the same thing. So that was Kaluza. And because they say, well, let's start with the field phi and say that it does not depend on y. So when it does not depend on y is when you have n equals to 0. So that's what Kaluza was doing, essentially only keeping the 0 mode and forgetting about all the higher modes. Like what? Yes, they will be there. They will be there, but they will be massive. They will include all the massive modes, so they will be all.
The integration of the y, don't they cancel because they have different frequencies?
Oh yes, thank you. Yes, thank you. Yes. Oof, that's true. I forgot about that. Yes. So they will be there, but they cancel. Yeah. And. When you integrate, yeah, you're right. But in any way, at the end, you will the massive modes in the first approximation. You can just integrate them out and just keep only the massless mode. And so, to make a difference between Kaluza and Klein, so only the zero mode This is what, as I told you, this is what Kaluza did. This is usually called. It's like having the original phi of x m was just phi of x mu, and please make the difference between n and mu here. Here, no y. And this is what Kaluza did, so he didn't have to do any Fourier expansion or anything like that. And this is something that is usually called as dimensional reduction. So just that means that you put fields in higher dimensions, but you set the fields to be independent of the extra dimensions at all. So that's Kaluza's way. Whereas Klein, and in this case, as I told you, dimensional reduction is equal to having the compactification on a circle and keeping only the zero mode. And so if we have, in the general case, this is what is called spontaneous compactification, or just compactification. And dimensional reduction, in this case, is just the limit when you have the compactification and keep only the zero mode. But this happens only because the extra dimension is a circle. If the extra dimension will not have been a circle, it's not the same thing just keeping the zero mode that will give you the dimensional reduction. So that's something to keep in mind, and we will see more often. And the reason is that the circle is flat, so it's a very simple case. Okay, so that's the difference between Kaluza-Klein compactification and dimensional reduction. But as I told you, the zero mode will always be the most important part because this is the thing that survives at low energies.
So your compactification is when you do the
full expansion. Exactly. When you keep all the extra modes, all the extra you keep all the Kaluza-Klein modes and say, well, they are suppressed, but they are there. Whereas in the other one, you just simply didn't have them. Very good. So that was the case of a scalar field. So now let's move on to the vector field. I have a few minutes. So massless vector. In 5D. So this introduces some extra things. So now we have an AN function of XM. Again, where M equals 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So this splits into two. It will split. So remember that before I split the coordinate into x mu's and y's. Now I have to split also the field itself into an a mu. And a 4 that I will call rho. Okay. Notice this thing. AM is a vector in five dimensions. A mu is a vector in four dimensions. Whereas A4 carries no four-dimensional indices, so it's just scalar. Okay? And for each of them, we can have the same thing. If the fourth coordinate is a circle, we can have a Fourier expansion for a mu and a Fourier expansion for rho. Okay. So for instance, a mu will be an infinite sum of a mu n e to the I n y over r, and the same thing for all. Good. And also, you start with a five-dimensional axiom. You will start, I'm sorry, we'll start with the integral of d5x 1 over g squared. And I will call this the five-dimensional gauge coupling, fmn. fmn. With, of course, fmn being the curl of A. Then we can do the same trick as we did for the scalar field. You can find the field equation. And the field equations would be essentially the Maxwell equation in five dimensions. That in terms of A's, I can write like dAm, dm an minus dm nam. And for this one, I can choose a gauge. I will finish in a couple of minutes. Choose a gauge, which is the transverse gauge. And remember that there is a gauge symmetry here for the electromagnetic field. So the transverse gauge, I choose dm am 0. And still there is a freedom that can be fixed by setting a 0 to 0. Yes? Oh, that will come later. Yes. I'm just doing exercise physics in five dimensions. What can we do? Take a field, a scalar field, and then what you get. Then take a vector field, then what you get. And then we will move to the Kaluza-Klein idea of having, starting with gravity, and then see that everything emerges from gravity. Okay. That will not work anyway, so don't raise us full expectations. But anyway. Okay, so we have that. And then we plug this into the action, as I did for the scalar field. And what is it that you will get? You will get, sorry, I will take one more minute. So that will get plugged into the action. Yes, if I choose this gauge, what I'm left with is that I'm left with an equation of dm n equal to 0. So that's again the same trick as before. We had a kind of a Klein-Gordon equation for a massless object, and the expansion will give us a lot of massive objects like in the scalar field. So this will, then we have similar to the scalar. That implies the infinite tower of modes, of massive modes. So when we plug into the action, the S5 lead us to an FS4D, which takes the form D4X after integrating over Y, then it will be 2 pi R divided by 5D squared times F mu nu, plus 2 pi R D mu, and this F mu will be the zero mode. F mu nu, zero, the zero mode, plus D mu rho zero D mu rho zero, plus the infinite tower of modes. And again, the most relevant ones will be the zero mode part, so we keep that. But from here, we can see that we're getting a Maxwell theory in four dimensions plus a scalar in four dimensions, massless also, plus the full tower. But in four dimensions, now this coefficient here will be the 1 over g squared in four dimensions, the gauge coupling in four dimensions. So 1 over g squared four dimensions, which is the coefficient of F mu nu, then equals to 2 pi r g squared 5d. So that means that the
second term not have that coefficient too.
This one?
Yeah.
I think you are right. I think you are right because it came out, yes. Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. But the important thing is this, something to keep in mind. And let me tell you the important physical implication of this. Remember, the gauge coupling in four dimensions is dimensionless. Okay, this is the gauge coupling is dimensionless. Now we have the gauge coupling in five dimensions cannot be dimensionless because you have this R here. So this ratio has to be dimensionless. Dimensionless. So that means that that's a fact actually. You go to extra dimensions, the corresponding gauge coupling is dimension full. And when you have dimension full couplings, you have to worry about being the theory non-renormalizable and these kind of things. So in that sense, four dimensions is a critical theory for electromagnetism or for in general for gauge interactions. Four dimensions is a nice one where you can have the coupling to be dimensionless, and then you can talk about normalization group running and everything very nicely. Okay. Thank you. Sorry for taking it so far.